Now we will have interaction, questions and answers session. Any of you who would like to put questions to the speakers or to any of us on Christianity and Vedanta or spiritual philosophy in general are most welcome to put those questions. A few requests. Those who would like to ask questions can put up their hands and mic will be handed over to them. But questions should be focused and specific and as far as possible in a few sentences. That would be highly appreciated. Thank you. Now we can go ahead.
So I would like to address my question to Mrs. Is it?
Doctor.
Dr.
DeBorg.
DeBorg, okay. You obviously, from your talk, have a lot of experience of dealing with multicultural religious organizations. So I would like to know what you consider to be the most essential of the essentials to understand in the study of peace.
Thank you, sir, for your question. I tried to outline that in my talk, but let me just revisit that again. And that is that we recognize in each other that all bear the presence of God, and that as bearing the presence of God, that is due respect and embracing one with thoughtfulness and care and authenticity. That is critical in the work that we do together. And to work very, very hard to not generalize about people of other faith. They're bad, they're this, they're that. It's very, very important that we not mystify, demonize, or make the other appear to be evil in any way. I do believe that each of us carries the presence of God within, and therefore that is goodness. And in that goodness, we must rise to our best selves in addressing that, our best selves. I'm aware that we are, as humans, there is that duality within us. And we can go down this path, which is about goodness, or we also have within each of us a dark side. And we can go down that side. We need to choose, and sometimes we need to choose almost minute by minute, day by day. But the important thing is to always lead with our best selves, our very best selves. Does that answer your question? Okay, thank you for it.
Hello. Thank you so much for the nice lecture. My question is for Swamiji, Hollywood. You talked about peace, and I understand that everybody wants to get peace, but as you mentioned, it's like a dog's tail. You try to straighten it, it again comes back to the normal behavior, nature. So could you please explain a little more how to find that peace, how we can go beyond that, like we don't come back to the same nature? Thank you so much.
All right. Well, I think it really does come to the point where you have to find it within, and then you will see more of it outside. As Swami Vivekananda said, haters see nothing but strife, lovers see nothing but love. So you have to try to find that peace within you so that you can see it outside, and then others will pick up on that, and that vibration will help them to be more peaceful. Psychologists will also tell you that when they're working with somebody, they at first perhaps try to mirror what the other person's feeling, but then try to draw them out into a new more healthy energy. And so that's what we have to model. We have to be able to model that. And I think there's an opportunity for anyone such as yourselves in whatever line of work you're doing to model that kind of peaceful behavior and to run your companies or your businesses in lines with spiritual principles so that the world can see that you can actually be a peaceful person. It's like Krishna said, you know, the action and inaction and the inaction and action. You have to incorporate that peace even amongst the turmoil, the seeming turmoil of the world.
Somebody, yes, from here.
Thank you for your lovely talks. Swami Advaitamananda, I would like to know if you could explain, elucidate a bit for us about how you discussed that. We would go to the gymnasium and exercise and get more fit, and we would not come back to the gymnasium and expect the gymnasium to be different. It's we who are different. But then you snuck in a little point there about if we're going to continue to get fit, we actually are changing resistances, lifting heavier weights. That was the analogy. How does that analogy work in spiritual life? What gets more difficult for our fitness?
Well, the analogy was actually meant to help us understand how to work in the world, how to work with a level of detachment, even when we try to fix the problems in the world, and as soon as we fix one problem, another one crops up. So it was that attitude. As far as our spiritual life goes, I hadn't really thought about it in those terms, but that can also be true. We can feel like we're not making any progress sometimes, or if we do make a little progress, we can't get complacent. We have to continually challenge ourselves to do a little more, rather than just going in and doing the same routine over and over. Continually ask yourself, what can I do to be a little bit better tomorrow than I was today?
I shall elaborate one point. You know, it is originally comes from Swami Vivekananda's statement, the world is a gymnasium for us to work out our karmas. That's the original quotation. What Swamiji meant was this: we live in this world, we work in this world, and we will have to interact with so many different kinds of people. We will have experiences, both happy and unhappy, pleasant and unpleasant. So how to look upon these experiences? When there is a happy experience, we become happy. When there is an unpleasant, unhappy experience, we become unhappy. So depression and joy. So how to go about this? So Vivekananda says, every experience should be looked upon as a means for you to go ahead in your spiritual life. Every physical feat that you do in a gymnasium helps you to build strong muscles. Similarly, whatever happens to us, whatever we have to receive from external world, and whatever experiences we have to go through, all these can be looked upon as a means, as a stepping stone to build up our spiritual life. So whole life can be spiritualized by looking upon all our activities as a spiritual practice. When you teach in school, when you work in an office, whatever work you do, if you can relate all these duties and responsibilities to God, to spirituality, then all these activities get a spiritual orientation. Then whole life gets spiritualized. As I said earlier, the secular and spiritual demarcation vanishes. Then whole life becomes a means, a vehicle for spiritual progress. That's the implication of Vivekananda's statement. Yes. Oh, yeah. Okay. We'll come. All of you will get a chance. Please come. Please.
My question is for both the doctor and the Swami. One of the components that cause wars and opposite of peace is the fact that we're overpopulating the earth. And that's the point made by the Swami. And one of the things that I was thinking is that since the animals do kill each other, especially when they're overpopulating an area, does that apply on people? The answer is yes, as the Swami said. So would you think that since the population ever increasing, we get to the point that killing is more than peace, that this instinctive behavior in us, in our genes, would even overcome what the religion has brought to us?
Would you like to start?
Gee, thanks. One of the things that I think is really important when we talk about war that hasn't been discussed yet, war is a great moneymaker. Mm-hmm. People profit from warring, and there are people out there that have no intention at all of being peacemakers. None. The profit is too great. The warmongers make millions, billions of dollars off of creating war. And we know that with our own government. Now, to answer the question about how other animals in the kingdom kill one another, my concern is that we're going to be warring about water in the state of California. That's on the horizon. It's certainly, we're in a drought situation in the greater Los Angeles area. As much food as produced, that's going to impact farming. And people may start digging in their heels about who's going to get that water and how much it's going to cost and where is it going to come from. And that could create some very, very sticky and untenable situations. I don't know. I'm just thinking in response to your question. My prayer is that we don't reach that point where, in order to feed our families, we're going to kill the family next door to get that food. That has certainly happened historically in our world. And I hope that we're more sophisticated than that. I hope that we have learned something. But the important thing in that is that we have to share. We have to share what we have. We can't hoard water. We can't hoard food. If we're intentional about sharing, I think that that very issue can be avoided. And now, Swami, from Vedanta of Hollywood, it's your turn. Okay.
It's a great question, and I had thought about it in preparation for this talk, because it seems like we have some choice here, but if we don't make some choices, we're going to end up killing off ourselves one way or another. We're either going to create widespread famine or widespread ecological disaster, or people are going to end up fighting over the limited resources that are there. But the other option would be to start voluntarily having fewer children and cutting the population down that way. If you educate people to understand that those are their choices, that hopefully will help. Another issue, and it's important, with the economics. If we could convince people that there's a lot of good business opportunities in providing more water and so forth for people, more education for people, perhaps they could turn their attention to solving some of those problems. If we can try to put our resources into solving the ecological problems, which is a global problem, so the global tribe of earthlings, if they can address that problem and make that their common goal, I think we'd go a long way to solving our problem.
I wanted to hear any or all of you the thoughts on the topic of the influence of religion on peace or the reducing of violence and so on. In terms of history, it has struck me, and I guess a lot of historians, that most of the religions and philosophies alive today started around the same period of time, about 2,500, 3,000 years ago. And my speculation is that things got so violent that the religions emerged to try to calm things down, shall we say, and that perhaps we're better off today with the influence of the various religious traditions than we would have been without them. But I wanted to get anyone who has a comment on that topic.
Perhaps Reverend Gibbard can give the Christian perspective of how religion became violent. And I can talk about Hinduism and like that. Because each religion had gone through this transition, this degeneration, so to speak.
Well, I want to begin by saying to my fellow Hindu sisters and brothers, just remember the importance of the mother in Hinduism. In my tradition, a male priest is called father and a female priest is called mother. So, I'm Christian because I was born in North America. For me, it's that simple. I could have been born in India and been Hindu or Buddhist. I could have been born in the Middle East and be Jewish or Muslim. I'm Christian because I was born in North America into a Christian family. I think there is greatness in our diversity. I think that we need that diversity. I am reminded of some of my Greek Orthodox brothers in Greek Orthodox, the Greek Orthodox Church, where Orthodoxy tends to be very grounded and in some ways static. But I think that other Christians need that groundedness. So as not to go off into some kind of la-la land, which many Christians do, and get away from the things that are really, really important. Your question, it wasn't clear to me exactly what your question is, and I hope that that's helpful to you.
I think go ahead.
I can't hear you, please.
It was about whether religion has had a positive effect in keeping peace, and perhaps religions got started in order to keep people more peaceful.
No, I don't believe it came about that way. I believe that that's a complex question. I probably need Alex to help me answer that question. But I believe that you know we're clearly very distinct in many ways, and yet there are great similarities, and I think we need the tension of both in order to be a peaceable people.
I think there's some truths to what you allude to in your question, that religion has been a force for keeping peace in society, certainly within the closed section of society, the smaller groups, in order to keep peace in those and to keep people civilized, to keep people from killing each other in the tribe, you could say. But then when it came to working with people of other faiths and other traditions, then it tended to create conflicts. But I think you're right. I think there was a peace-building effort. I don't think that's really why religion started. I think it started, I'm not a historian of ancient religions, but from little I've read, there's this yearning in people to figure out what their place in the universe is. Why are we here? What's our relationship with the place we find? And what happens to our ancestors? And then once you get into this idea that there's an afterlife, then there's a concept of some deity that's in charge of things and in charge of the forces of nature, trying to explain why things happen in nature. And so religion evolves like that. And then it takes on a role of organizing society and keeping the society together, keeping it healthy, and keeping it run efficiently. And then it gets into these other problems. But I think that's kind of my take on it.
Well, if you look at religious scriptures, if you look at the teachings of the great founders of religions, all religions, you find there are two types of teachings. The one kind of teachings, universal spiritual ideas, peace, humanity, love, compassion, liberation from the present existing conditions, the idea that we are coming from a state of perfection and we are going towards a state of perfection, and this life is an intermediary stage which needs to be improved. Now, the other aspect is the secondary details of religions, the socio-anthropological, cultural, ethnic, and tribalistic aspects of every religion. To give an example, if you look at Hinduism, you find Hinduism in its various stages of evolution as being influenced by the customs, habits, anthropological, sociological, cultural aspects of Indian subcontinent. If you look at Christianity, Islam, and Judaism, they have been influenced by the tribalistic, socio-anthropological aspects of Middle East, and so on. Now, very often what happens, we give much more importance, we attach much more importance and significance to the secondary details, the cultural, tribalistic, nationalistic, socio-anthropological aspects, completely forgetting the highly universal spiritual teachings which are relevant and important for all times. When I read the Bible, I am coming from a very, very conservative Hindu tradition, had to study Sanskrit from the age of 5 and Vedas. But when I read the Bible, there are in the Old Testament, I find many tribalistic ideas. The whole history is not a very pleasant experience to read. But if you read the Sermon on the Mount, if you read the great parables of Jesus, they are wonderful teachings. They are on the same level, as far as I understand, with the Upanishads of the great Vedantic teachings. So if a Christian says, well, the socio-anthropological and cultural, ethnic, tribalistic teachings are much more important than the Sermon on the Mount, then I may not be able to agree with that. If you read the Vedas, you'll find many ideas which are very similar to what you find in the Old Testament, which again may not be very pleasant. But the Upanishads teach about spiritual universal humanism, which teaches you to look upon the whole humanity, not only humanity, the whole creation as one. The unity and oneness of creation is a central theme of the Vedantic literature. That idea you find in the Sermon on the Mount, in many of the wonderful parables, the works of Eckhart, you find. But you may not find in the mainstream theologians. But if you read the great mystics like Eckhart, you find the same ideas that you find in Upanishads. So what we need to do today to bring peace, or rather to give peace a chance, is to de-emphasize the secondary details, the cultural, socio-anthropological, linguistic details, and re-emphasize the spiritual, the universal element in religious scriptures. In fact, we did a great injustice to the great prophets. Every prophet was crucified not once, many times. Every time we try to put the tribalistic element above and beyond the universal element, we are defeating the purpose of the great prophets of the world. So that's what we need to do. So we have to re-emphasize the spiritual elements. That's the one.
I'd like to add a piece to that, if I may, and that is that whatever faith or religion one embraces, primary and before that is that each of us views the world to a specific filter. And on that filter, like I'll take myself as an example, would be that I'm female, I am the firstborn in my family, I come from I came to this work out of self-defense, in that my father was French-Canadian, born in this country, Roman Catholic. My mother was from Missouri, Southern Baptist, so their children were reared in the United Methodist Church. And And when I was away at school, my father converted to Judaism and was a very devout Jew, very devout Jew. So that's part of, as I said, I came to this work out of sheer self-defense. So all of that, my political affiliation is on that filter. Many, many things are on each of your filters that impact how you read Scripture and interpret Scripture and how you embrace your faith theologically. In Christianity, as you know, there is a broad spectrum of very progressive Christians, and I would include myself in that vein, to fundamentalists or evangelicals, which are way, way, way to the right. And fundamentalists read the Bible as inerrant and infallible, forgetting that God may have spoken to a prophet, but that prophet had his own filter on which he wrote out the Scripture. So I think that filter is a very, very important thing for us all to keep in mind as we work toward peace. I mean, maybe you have folks in your families that have served in the armed services. And here it is, Memorial Weekend. As noble as that is, that may impact how you feel about war. I'm just putting that out there as a possibility. So I think it's important for you to be alone with self, to have a very honest conversation with yourself about what is the filter through which I observe life. Also, socioeconomic would be on that filter as well. So I would ask you, perhaps in the days and weeks ahead, to really look at your filter. How does that impact your interpretation of Scripture? Mm-hmm. How does that impact your theological position? And how does that impact your concern for stewardship of the earth and stewardship for other people?
Swami Atma. This question has to do with realization. You know, the one with the capital R? And there's one perspective that says, there's nothing I can really do about my realization at the end of the day. It's pure destiny. That comes from Ramana Maharshi. And then there's all kinds of other perspectives to do this and to do that and to do this and to do that. So based on your extensive Vedantic background, do you have any thoughts on that?
Is this sort of a self-effort and grace question?
Self-effort and grace, or is that part of the illusion as well?
Well, yeah, that's an interesting. Yes, that's the dilemma. Everything that we're doing here is within the illusion, and it's sometimes difficult to pin everything down. But my take is that we do have to make our effort. As Sri Ramakrishna said, you have to at least set your sail, or you're never going to catch the breeze of grace. But that ultimately, it is a matter of grace as to when and how we receive the illumination and the realization. And once you've experienced that, the reason they say, oh, it's just grace, is that because the experience is so overwhelming, you can't imagine anything that you did to get it. So it always feels like you didn't do anything and it's just grace, but the spiritual aspirants have had to do a lot of discipline to make themselves ready to receive it.
Thank you. I really love the theme of today. And I'm always working for peace in my life on every level with meditation and trying to surround myself in a community of people that are like-minded on that same level of theme. But, you know, there's always the challenge of the world around you, the outside world, with the news and the broadcasting of all the horrible news and the terrible things that are going to happen. And then you get around your friends and they start discussing and starting to argue about it when you start to suggest, well, why don't we think about peace? So with all the agitation that's in the outside world, if you can give us tips, you know, you've made some wonderful suggestions about being godlike and seeing God in all the things around you and going within and meditating. But in this case, with all this outside chaos, what can we do? Thank you.
Of course, we have some choices to the friends we keep and the shows we watch and the news programs we watch. So that's if it gets too bad. You have to find a new circle of friends or change the channel or turn it off.
Well, I agree with what Swami just said. It's like we don't need to keep that rat race running with that kind of information. It's very, very damaging to our spirituality, and it renders a lot of people without having an eschatology of hope, a future of hope. And there are many, many wonderful things that are working in the world, very, very much so. People are doing extraordinary things. How many of you are on Facebook? Okay, you know from being on Facebook that an example would be that you see the real horror of the abusiveness toward many animal species, including farm animals. Countering that are extraordinary stories of people like Animal Defenders International that have gone through South America. They're now in Peru, and they're saving all the lions and many monkeys and taking them to a sanctuary in Denver. People are doing extraordinary things out there. And we must support them with prayer and also financially. And we have to be aware of the good news that's happening out there. I don't know that my friend said to remind people of all the hopeful things that are happening. People are very frightened right now. Our society is very, very, very frightened right now. And if you say to someone, it's like saying to a kid, there's a jar of cookies, don't touch it. You know what's going to happen. So I think that if you have a conversation with someone who is determined to look at only the negative things that are happening, they're going to get pushed in a corner with that. The best thing that you can do is to be a model of living a peaceful life.
Namaste. Both speakers have been very good today, this morning. We're highly inspirational and entertaining with humor as well. Thank you very much. I have two questions, if I may. One, certainly the climate of violence today has been terrible and looks very hopeless. However, if you look back on history, there has always been violence. We look at Ramayana, the intrigue and injustice and kidnapping and war. And then Mahabharata is all about war. And throughout the ages, we've been having all kinds of wars and atrocities and tortures and all that. Will we ever have a day of hope and peace? My question. Second question specifically to Swami Atmavidyananda. Swamiji, you told us today that everything is Brahman, all is Brahman. Does that mean that includes the violent elements as well? And if so, how can one part of Brahma can be violent? And if you say that is due to Maya or ignorance, how did they happen due to Brahman? And then if it's free will, why does God give us free will to do the wrong things? Thank you.
Well, remember, it really isn't happening. It just looks that way. When we wake up from the dream, then hopefully we'll be able to laugh at all of it. But yes, we have to accept the fact that everything comes from Brahman, and it's this dilemma that when you create something out of oneness, you have to have pairs of opposites, you have to have dualities. That's just the nature of an apparent creation out of oneness. And so we end up with both violence and peace. But you see, and somebody reminded me, I never named the third guna. The third guna is the sattva guna. The sattva guna reveals the nature of the reality underneath. And so we have to go after the sattvic qualities in the world in the correct way so that we can enhance our chances for our own liberation and waking up from the dream.
I would think your question has got one basic misunderstanding behind. The whole Advaita philosophy has been terribly misunderstood. Advaita, that's the philosophy you're referring to. Brahman means the absolute reality. And the one who realizes that absolute reality can never do violence to anybody. Because when you realize that absolute reality, you identify your unity with the rest of the creation. You will understand that when you harm others, when you do harm to another person, you are doing harm to yourself. Those who realize this truth can and will never do any harm to anybody. Now, this is the goal. In fact, this great philosophy is also the most profound ethical philosophy, foundation of ethical philosophy. The idea that I should not do harm to my neighbor, not because God will punish me, but because by hurting my neighbor, I'll be hurting myself.
Right.
So the basic principle of unity of creation, the idea that entire humanity is one spiritual family, this is the essence of Vedanta. This is the idea of Brahman. When we talk about violence, when you talk about people who practice violence, we are talking about people who have not understood, not realized this truth. Look at those who have realized this truth. Somebody was referring to Ramana Maharshi or Sri Ramakrishna or Shankaracharya, Vivekananda, all these, Jesus, Buddha, all of them. They talked about unity of existence. They talked about peace and compassion beyond the tribalistic, narrow, nationalistic, cultural boundaries because they realized this oneness of existence. In fact, that is the whole essence of the idea of Brahman. Not Brahma, but Brahman, that's meaning. That's a word. Which is the absolute reality. And this idea, when it becomes an experience, it makes you a better human being. You become more compassionate. You become more humane. That's the idea of Advaita. So there's an important point. If there was a Hitler because he did not realize this truth. If there was an Attila the Hun because he did not realize the truth. If there is a Ramana Maharshi or Jesus, because they did realize this truth, that's a basic difference.
I would like to address the first question that you had, sir. You're right. Violence has been a part of humanity's history since the beginning of time. There's a difference today. Here's the difference. Violence has become the normative. Violence has become the normative. How many kids are going to have to be killed by a gun before there is serious gun reform in this country? How many women worldwide are going to continue to be abused, raped, tortured, sold into sex slavery at 10, 11, 12 years of age, before the world does something about it? Those things, kids getting killed by a gun, it's a normative. Hardly a week goes by, we turn on the news, and there it is. The normative of police, a police state, has become the normative in this country. People are being hurt. Those kids in Ferguson, they're your kids. Those kids that get killed by a gun, they're your children. Those kids that have been orphaned in Nepal, they're our children. violence has become the normative. And even violence, that the earth is erupting, it's saying, I'm tired, you're failing me, I'm dying, help me. All of that has become the normative, and that's tragic, because when it's norm, the norm, we look away. We look away. The point that the Holocaust Museum makes in the city of Los Angeles, and the correct name for the Holocaust is the Shoah, is that the Holocaust occurred because ordinary people made it so. Ordinary people made it so. We, as ordinary people, must do something extraordinary in this world to step up, stop the gun violence, stop abusiveness of women and girls, help those in tremendous need. We have to step up.
Thank you for your presentations. So I think there's general agreement that the world isn't a place that we like very much, and we'd like it to be different. So that involves change, and how do we go about becoming agents of change? And it seems to me that so much of, we'll call it political activism, is really acts of opposition to what is. And my view of opposition is it is not peace. So we cannot come from peace and oppose what is happening. How do we handle resist not the evil man? This is a great conundrum for me. Mm-hmm. When we don't like what we're seeing, we want it to change, and how do we have that happen? And it seems that the other piece of this is, do I have to make a choice if I want to be an agent of change to being a contemplative and being peace within myself and emanating that as a way of change? Must I make a choice between that or some form of political activism?
You can, of course, the way you consume things can be an influence. If you choose products from companies that are more just and more holistic, more interested in nature, if you don't go to violent movies, you don't buy violent video games, there are some things you can do as a consumer to help promote this in a very direct way. If you're a filmmaker, make a film that's nice and pleasant for a change, that doesn't have people blowing each other up. So things like that, whatever it is that you're in, we can't all do everything. We each have our specialties. So whatever way you can figure out in your life to help support more peaceful, loving ideas, that's what you should do.
I don't think it has to be either or. I think it takes both. And each of us brings to our life different gifts and different talents. We need the monastics in all the faiths that pray all day long for world peace. And we need the tension of those that are out in the streets with the signs saying, we need, you know, stop this or do this or do that. I think it takes both. It's not an and or a choice. But the important thing is, where do you individually and personally want to be in that movement toward peace? That's the big question. Where do I want to be? Do I want to be on the picket line, or do I want to be living some kind of celibate monastic life? It takes all of it. It takes all of it.
This is for the whole panel, anybody who would like to speak. But lately I've been finding myself a magnet for injustice. And so I'm seeing that my work, my karma, if you will, seems to be standing in the face of that with as much love as I possibly can. I'm a very fortunate person to have been exposed to a book called Love is Letting Go of Fear by Gerald Jampolsky at the age of 16. Mm-hmm. Skinny, simple book. Mm-hmm. And so when people say the sky is falling from whatever political persuasion, I don't really pay much attention. I say, well, it's not hitting me on the head yet. That's just rain, or you're standing under a eucalyptus tree or something. But I'm finding it very challenged, and I recently spent just a few hours with my family yesterday, who I love dearly. They exposed me to Buddhism because my mom started going to Tassajara before the Buddhists got there. They exposed me to Vedanta because my real estate developer father bought a house across the street from the Society's center in Sacramento. They exposed me to Christianity because they sent me to YMCA camp when I was 13, and I raised my hand and accepted Jesus as my personal savior. And when I was in jail on a domestic violence charge because my wife became violent and beat me, so it's a lot of men get this too, and she called 911 10 days after we had seen therapists and talked to other families, and she was abusing my eldest son. And I intervened in a very nonviolent, peaceful way without saying anything. I put my hand on his leg and her leg, as a family therapist had told us. And the next thing I know, I'm talking to sheriffs in my driveway. My parents are very wealthy people. They travel all over the world. They cannot find it in their pocketbooks or their hearts to help me get my teeth fixed or my car fixed so I can get a job. I live in the back of a 300-square-foot storage space because they cannot find it in their hearts or their pocketbooks to delay a trip to Hawaii or Italy to help their son who needs some help. And the part that hurts more is that they cannot find it in their hearts when I say I would like to come with you to Southern California and see my cousins. I'm too polluted or dangerous or dirty somehow because I've been homeless, because I've struggled with issues of sexuality, of all these other issues that are very much in the forefront today. I'm too polluted to sit down to dinner with them for their friends in San Francisco. I'm too polluted to even sit in the car with them for more than an hour. The visits are so prescribed. This is very painful. These are people I love dearly. They've exposed me to wonderful things, given me many opportunities. So in many ways, not just with them, I find myself struggling against injustice, against judgment, huge negative judgment in my own family. I feel like a second-class citizen. I've lived in a halfway house where the people were taking the money that I earned by my sweat. They weren't maintaining the house. They weren't providing the therapy that I was supposed to get. And they were abusing me. And all I was doing was sharing my food and trying to help fix things around this house and be open-hearted and generous with my brothers who are parolees living in this house. I find myself facing injustice everywhere I go, and I find it very challenging not to become angry, not to become judgmental. The belt I wear was made for my grandfather, who was the head of sales for Remington on the San Francisco from 1949 to 1969. He taught many children
would
how to shoot.
Would you excuse me? Would you excuse me?
How do I deal with this injustice and hold on to mother's question or mother's suggestion of not giving in to finding fault? I'm finding myself very challenged.
Can you just give your question directly? The question they will answer. Please.
The question is, how do I stand up to injustice? How do I stand in the face of that without finding fault in others? So I'm just trying to give the depth and the breadth of what I'm dealing with here, and it's not easy. And I've known Vedanta since I was 16.
That's always a very difficult situation. It's whenever you have people, as the Reverend said, people come in with their different filters, and it seems so obvious to us what is injustice, and other people are simply blind to it, and they simply don't even see it. Somehow, if you can hold it in your heart to try to pray for them that they will be able to see their own faults, usually the more you point them out to them, the less they'll be able to see them. They begin to build up a wall, and you And so you feel like you're talking to a brick wall because people just don't like to hear that they're wrong. And they will put all their filters on they possibly can to see that they haven't done anything wrong, that all the problems are somewhere else. So you have to, it's a huge challenge, and why some of us, such as yourself, have had to put up with so many challenges like that is a deep mystery of that no one can really give an adequate answer to. And I'm not sure I've helped you much, but that would be my take on it.
I am deeply sorry for the pain that you're in with what you shared with us. I want to say something to you. It comes from my heart, and I pray that you accept it in the spirit in which it's given to you. You have a secret that you're keeping from yourself, and that is your competency. If you look to your competency, the other will fall away. And I pray that you take that in the spirit in which I have given it to you.
Hi. Thank you. So I guess I'm wondering which institutionalized religion is going to take the prize that's waiting for it. And what I mean by that is, personally, I believe that peace is here and it's coming into our consciousness. The world's remembering who it is. We're all remembering who we are. I don't think that we're, you know, even if we blow ourselves up, we'll blow ourselves up much more awake than we've been. Okay? So, my question is which religion's going to take the prize? There's all these major institutionalized religions, which if they, like, the Swami in the middle was saying, if we follow the teachings of the masters, and if some great figure, like a Gandhi-like figure, stood up and said, anybody who's in the Catholic faith, if you want to call yourselves Catholic, you can't participate in the military. Because Jesus said XYZ, right? So I guess I'm wondering, you're out there, you're looking at the leaders of your faith. Which faith is going to take that prize? And suddenly, instead of being the promoters of all of their children that come to church being cannon fodder, which one is going to stand up and say, you know what, you don't need to be cannon fodder anymore?
What does that mean, cannon fodder? I don't know what that means. What does it mean?
We're fighting for freedom. We're fighting for freedom. And, okay. And that's cannon fodder.
Okay. I really didn't know what that meant, so I just need
meaning like you're catching bullets for somebody else.
Okay.
Cannon fodder.
Okay.
Big bullets, big round shells.
Got it. Okay.
Okay. So my question is, do you know of any specific, like maybe the Pope or anybody really at the point where they're about to emerge as a Gandhi-like figure who can lead us? Because I think peace is going to come in about 5 minutes once everybody gets it. And it's going to happen fast, and it's going to be beautiful. I don't think it's going to be some big struggle. And you know, we're already doing the big struggle. But when the consciousness shifts, everybody wants peace. Everybody wants it. So
No, they don't. Not everyone wants peace.
Well, they just don't agree on how they're going to go about getting it.
No, they don't. As I said before, huge billions of dollars are made off of waging war. Billions of dollars. That's part of our in-the-moment reality. That is a truth. That really is a truth.
War and John Boehner refused to come. So the thing that, what's his name, the poet from Chicago said, someday they'll give a war and nobody will come.
Right.
Okay. So I guess who's going to lead us? I would just ask for each one of you to speak for maybe a minute. Who's emerging that's going to lead us to this next plateau of peacefulness in, within each religion that's speaking today?
I think this is already happening on smaller scales. So you'll find the religious leaders in various countries have been coming together to convince the governments or the warring parties in particular countries to come together the only example that's coming right to mind is in Mozambique, where the religious leaders convinced the people having a civil war to stop the civil war and to come to a peace agreement. So it happens on smaller scales. I think the Pope has reached out going to the Middle East and so forth. The Dalai Lama certainly does a lot of that. So each organization does it in their own way and in their own locality and specific incidences. It doesn't get a lot as enough press, but it does happen.
Yeah, I hate to think of religions being in competition with each other, number one. You know, the problem with great religious leaders is that they all get assassinated. Mm-hmm. Truly, Gandhi was assassinated, Martin Luther King was assassinated. Every morning when I wake up, I pray for the Holy Father, Pope Francis. He is hated by the conservative branch of the Roman Catholic Church. Now, here's the thing. Every person in this tent is a leader. Every person here is a leader. It's not that one guy or gal who's going to do it for us. I think it's going to take all of us living a peaceful life and moving toward peace in the world.
In fact, the very fact that all of us have assembled here to discuss the topic religion for world peace itself shows that there are people who are enlightened, who are aware of the problem. That gives a great hope to all of us. So that's one way of emergence of a new paradigm, a new mindset, new outlook. And people are realizing the need for religion for world peace. That itself is a great achievement.
Greetings.
Greetings.
And thank you for all of you have had to offer today. It's been really fun. So many correlations to the question I want to ask. It's hard to pull them all together, but for me, an underlying key necessity, you know, with all that's been going on with the discussions of war, and what drives that all is fear. And certainly, you know, capitalism figured out that fear is a very easy way to sell things and things like that. So there's a lot of money behind all of that, as has been noted. And fear is the enemy of trust. And trust seems like the really underlying driver for peace then emerging, because so much of what's happening is due to lack of trust. And it's easy for us neurologically to learn how to not trust through betrayal and things like that, and for survival. So it's learning how to trust again and getting that trust back that seems like the underlying driver for peace in the world and compassion and everything else. So I'm kind of curious about any of your thoughts about how to sort of turn that around and how to sell trust back to the world and even teach people to trust again. Because, you know, it's easy to learn how to not trust. It's much harder to then reverse that and learn to trust. So I'm kind of curious about your thoughts about that.
Yes. Swami Vivekananda said that fear disappears when you realize the oneness of all beings. Fear comes when you see yourself as separate. So the more you can cultivate that feeling of oneness, in a very simple way, just between two people, you can experience something. If you put your hand on a person's heart and they put their hand on your heart and you just sit there in silence, you will experience a kind of connection at a deeper nonverbal level. It's that kind of level of trust that has to be experienced. And of course, education and the types of things that the Guy Bourdes Center does and that we do from the Vedanta Society and going to a lot of interfaith things, all of those things help. When I was on some panels at a high school, that all of the panelists kind of complained that there really wasn't much time to do much, and the teacher said, "Don't worry about it. I just want the students to see you all sitting together in a peaceful setting." So it's that kind of thing that can help to build trust.
I would just add that if we're to rebuild trust, our governmental institutions, our religious institutions, our educational institutions, and we as individuals must behave trustworthily.
Mm-hmm. I'm Martha Peterson. One person can make a big difference. I was in the Peace Corps twice after age 55. One in Africa, helping blind people, and two, Pakistan. And in every case, I learned to love the people. They love to know me. And so just one person kind of spreads love and compassion, just being themselves. If they're Christian, I'm also an Episcopalian. But that's what I say. I was 55 when I started out and 74 when I quit in India. And I just learned to love the people, the music, the culture, and it rebounded. And you're living by grace finally, because you don't take thought and everything just happens and flows, and it's a good way to go. Thank you.
Deb, from the podium we heard really wonderful, uplifting ideas from Swamiji's and the Reverend. Now, my big question, most of it was more or less focused on your individual betterment and how it can really contribute to a total better social order, which is a very important aspect, no doubt. But an equally important issue is really group conflicts, the extreme cases of war, but bigger riots, everything else, which some of it, a lot of it, has been inspired by quote-unquote religious differences. And it has happened, and religion to many people has brought a bad name just because of it. Whether it's deserving or not, I don't want to get into that argument. And a lot of time, a short shrift is given by saying, oh, that's not really religion, that's really concocting the wrong, you know, interpretation of religion. Jihad actually doesn't mean this, or Hindus never meant this, the Vedanta, Brahman, and all the huge concepts which most people never heard of. But, you know, the jihad is the ISIS is a real, real issue at this point in time. But we are not the only, they are not the only ones. We'd be foolhardy to deny it. I still cannot deny the 2002 riots in Gujarat and the many wars, etc., have been caused, whether by the name of religion or by the misinterpretation of religion. And several speakers have brought out our tribal natures, and maybe whether that really overrules our thing. What can religion do? Is there any hope that that situation can be changed, or at least attempt to change? It's really idealistic to think an individual, as this lady just before said, an individual can do a lot. But usually that's not enough. How do you change a Hitler? How do you change the ISIS? How do you change the Gujarat riots? You know, individual cannot just do that. So somehow the real religious leaders or religious concepts need to come to the fore, to the individuals themselves.
Thank you. Now we'll discuss with the Swami Atmavidyananda may respond to your questions.
Well, yes, you know, of course, with what we have in the Bhagavad Gita with Arjuna and Krishna, they tried all sorts of things to try to solve the problem without a war, and nothing worked, even with Sri Krishna there. So sometimes it's very difficult to uphold dharma and protect innocent people without being prepared to fight for it. It's very difficult. And all of these different conflicts you had, they're all going to have a different difficulty that you'd have to look at. In each case, we can try to learn from those cases and try to figure out what strategy might have worked if we had tried it, so that if it comes up again. But it's very difficult. And, you know, I'm not a politician by any means, but from the spiritual standpoint, I think we've pretty much covered it, that you have to do what you can do. And when you see that the world's not changing, you have to at least try to work on yourself and build an energy of peace that way.
I would just add in response to that statement and question that it's very important that we truly understand ISIS has nothing to do with Islam. Zero. Zero. And to put that on Islam, for any of us to put that on Islam, is only adding to an ongoing issue. We need to be very, very careful that the radical people that are out there truly are not embracing the teachings of our prophets, whoever the prophets may be, in different religious communities. And we must separate that out. And it's very disturbing to me when even the term jihad is misunderstood. Mm-hmm. Jihad means to struggle with oneself. That's what the true meaning of jihad. And so to say that all people who are involved in the horrific crimes of ISIS are Muslims, they are not Muslims. That is not the Muslim community that I embrace in love with my whole heart. They're just not. So we have to always continue to separate out, folks.
Good.
If I have the microphone, may I ask a question?
Please.
It's been a wonderful day. I felt that something was a little bit missing here, and the last comments brought it back to my mind. It seems to me that praying for peace is lovely, but it's much more effective, I think, and I hope religion can help us in this way, that we pray for our enemies, pray for those that we disagree with. The idea of not criticizing or condemning other people, no matter how wrong we think they are, understanding that everybody on this planet, with a very few exceptions, believes what they're doing is right. And I certainly don't agree with the Islamic State, so-called, or what they're doing. And I certainly understand that there are much higher visions of Islam. And I consider myself a Sufi student. And I love that. But I think what we really need to do... Oh, I'm sorry, this is not such a question. I would like to ask, can religion help us to reach out, even those people we think are doing something horrible, as Gandhi wanted to reach out to Hitler and couldn't quite, and see them as people who are well-intentioned, even if totally wrong, and find some common ground and try to dissolve this terrible mounting escalation of the conflict, which I believe does have roots in different religious traditions. Even, again, there are so many parts to every religion. I just don't think we can say it is or isn't a religion. So I'm hoping that in the Vedanta tradition too, is there something similar to when Jesus says, pray for your enemies, love those who persecute you? Does that resonate? And can that help us to understand and diffuse some of these tensions, particularly in the Middle East?
I shall just point out a few important points that we should keep in mind in a discussion like this. The whole purpose of holding a debate or a discussion or interaction like this is to evolve a new outlook towards religion, spirituality, and the connection between peace and religion. So we need not focus on any particular individual religion or its problems or conflicts, because that will be defeating the very purpose of holding such a wonderful program. So all of us have assembled here to discuss as to how we can evolve a new approach towards the problem of religion and peace. So we need not focus or criticize any particular religious tradition. Rather, we must focus on what I said earlier, re-emphasizing the spiritual element, the universal humanistic spiritual element that could be found in all religious traditions, including Islam. So leave alone those who do not understand this aspect of that particular tradition. Rather, we have to focus on the positive elements, the spiritual elements that unify different faith systems, and project and emphasize and stress on those aspects, so that a new mindset, a new awareness will emerge to project the spiritual, the universal, the humanistic elements of different faith systems. That should be our purpose, not individually focused on or any particular religious tradition or input or events, unfortunate events, riots or conflicts. We need not emphasize those points, because there are so many platforms where politicians discuss those things. But there are not many platforms where people discuss these important issues. So let us make the best use of a platform like this to focus on the spiritual, the unifying, the humanistic elements of different faith systems. So
there are some efforts to...
Thank you, Swami. Thank you very much.
...to facilitate negotiations between warring parties. There are efforts to facilitate that through meditation and through, as Dr. Gibor says, people studying their filters. What is their filter that they've had on, and can they get that off? And what's the filter that the other party has on, and can they try to put that on themselves and see things in that light? If each side is willing to do that to a certain extent, then there's some hope that negotiations can have some success. And a meditative process actually has been tried and shown to help be effective. Now, convincing people to do that is another question, but that kind of process has been explored and is being explored. Did you want to say something, Reverend?
No.
Okay.
Swami, I have this question. I'm by profession an engineer, so we take a project. Let me illustrate this way what I'm asking. We do a building, I design buildings. Now we have to report to client, is 30% complete, 40% complete, 65% complete. So let's take religious conflict as a project. And we have been doing harmony of religious meeting. I've been involved in Chicago, Cape Town, South Africa, Barcelona. We are meeting again in Salt Lake City in 2016, Parliament of Religion. And we have been doing this for the last 22 years. As an engineer, let me ask, what percentage of this project is complete? 20%, 30%? How close we are?
It's ongoing. It's sort of it's sort of like taking things out of one of those bins at the supermarket. You know, you scoop it out and more just falls down, you see. So
but when we try to resolve this conflict, we evolve. The yes. conflicts may or may not get resolved during our time. When we work for peace, when we discuss the problem of violence and how to establish peace in the world, when we discuss spiritual topics in a platform like this, when we interact, we evolve, we grow. So let us forget about the percentage of problems we have solved or the amount of problem yet to be solved. Rather, when we become aware of this, we become more peaceful and we become more spiritual. Every noble thought, every noble endeavor, every noble word, every noble act helps us in our spiritual path. And if more and more people gather next year, if we get 2,000 people like you, we will evolve still further. 2,000 more people will become familiar with these great noble ideas. So that's the way to do. So we evolve, and more, as more and more people get enriched with these ennobling ideas, then that's a great thing that we are doing for the world. That's the idea.
In regard to what has been said, particularly in the last few questions, the evidence of love and desire and peace that we witness here needs to get to the world. Is this on Facebook?
Well, I think today is being live streamed, so there are people out there, and I think a DVD or something, CD is going to be made of it, and so that's a way. And you know, I will be your PR person for next year. Bring a friend next year for this gathering. Bring a family. Bring children old enough to start to engage in this conversation. Bring someone with you so that this exponentially grows every year. I hear there were a little over 700 people here this morning. Let it be 1,000 people next year, or 10,000 people, and the year after, 12,000 people. It's okay, I'm just doing this for you, Swami. Okay.
And there's a Parliament of Religions in Salt Lake City in the middle of October, so you can go online and sign up for that.
Swamiji, I have a question on the pitfalls of the prescriptive nature of any religion. I find Vedanta is very dynamic. It is kind of generalized a religion because you can interpret the way you like it. So it has gone, it has not bounded in terms of time, space. It has gone beyond time. So that's why when I asked Swamiji that karmanne badhikaraste mahaphaleshu karachana kadachana, I'm trying to explain to my my boss in Lawrence Livermore lab. He said, oh, I like your idea. I don't have to give you any more raise, any more promotion. So I'm very good at it. So the question is, I go to Swamiji and I say, Swamiji said, hold on, I'm writing a book on Gita. So all Swamijis are writing an interpretation of Gita. On the other hand, I see some other religions are very prescriptive. And I asked my friend, they said, well, I am completely bound by my prescriptive nature of my religion. I cannot come out of it. So I think that is one of the things. I don't know whether we can change the prescriptive nature of any religion. That is my question.
Somebody else have an answer? I think you, in some sense, you mentioned that we don't have quite as strict a thing, and I think interfaith, though, helps. When you, even as a Vedantist, it helps me to understand what are the really essential things about a religion, and what are just the things that just happen to be there because it happened to grow up in this particular country at this particular time. So if you get a wider perspective of different religious traditions and how they practice, it gives you some insight. But how you convince some other people to do that, I don't know. That's the question. Again, you can just model it and try to show them that it works for you.
Hello, and a wonderful day it is to sit in a room with so many people whose focus is to share love and to be giving. Every time someone speaks, I come up with another question. So I've had so many, I'm not asking them. I'm just going to stay with the one question, that God has given me the project of twins in my life, my children. They're turning 12. And it's not in adolescence that we teach. We teach when they're in the womb. And my children are wonderful. I have taught them God. We look for a leader outside ourselves, and we don't know that the leader is in the room. All of us are the leaders of peace. I taught my children that when they were in the womb. God gave me twins when I was 45 years old. I got pregnant. I had 5 fertility doctors tell me it would never happen. So I went to the 6th fertility doctor. He says, I'll try. Let's try it. So I have these daughters, and that is my work. That is my religion. When my daughters were 18 months old, they were sitting in their car seat. I was driving. My one daughter said to her sister, Lily, Lily, Lily. Lily wasn't answering. I looked in the rearview mirror. She wasn't sleeping. She wasn't answering. I waited. And so Catherine again said, Lily, Lily. Nothing was happening. And finally, Lily said, Catherine, I'm not talking to you right now. I'm talking to God. And I felt in that moment, I'm on the right track as a parent to teach peace and kindness. My one daughter still suffers from the disease of needing to be first and right, first and right. My work is to show her that right and first is not the answer. And that's our issue in the world. Everyone thinks they're right and they need to be first. If we could all find a way to be kind and ask 2 questions, what can I do for us to be at peace? And how can I be there? No one's right, and no one needs to be first. We just all need to be together. Thank you.
Hello. I'm hearing a lot of overlaps with A Course in Miracles, which I'm a student of, which teaches that the world is an illusion, and seek not to change the world, but to change your mind about the world, and that we are all projecting our movie on a screen, and we have to change what we're projecting. We have to come from love instead of fear, as you know. We can't go up to the screen and change the movie, but the more of us who change our minds, the more we'll be projecting peace. And it talks a lot about looking directly at the ego and undoing the ego so that the love can come through, that the love is there. And that we can be an activist, still be an activist, or do what we're going to do, but we're just coming from the perspective of peace or the Holy Spirit. And I just wanted to thank you for all the overlaps that I'm hearing. Thank you.
Thank you. Hi. I just wanted to thank you so much for this program today and wanted to ask the question again about how we can most skillfully love our enemies, because my Christian upbringing side, my traditional roots, is saying, well, call it like you see it. And then my Eastern leaning side is saying, don't believe everything you see. So I guess my question really is, what is the skillful interfaith way of loving our enemies and recognizing when people are veering off course, including ourselves?
Well, as my song said, conquer your enemies by making them your friend. If you can see one thing that you really admire in somebody that you're feeling is an enemy for some reason, then try to focus on that and amplify that and let them know how much you appreciate that quality, and that will start to break the barriers down. I've noticed with just normal human interactions, there's some people that are very forthright and outspoken, and sometimes it can be a little irritating and people get annoyed that they don't always agree with you, and they speak their mind, and they might have an argument with you. But some of those people are very skillful. The next day they come back as though nothing has happened, that there was never any argument. And it completely breaks down all of this tension you had built up, like, oh, what am I going to do when I have to see that person again? You know, from there, they've completely forgotten about it, and it helps you to completely forget about it. So we can do something to help break those barriers.
That reminds me very much of Jesus and the woman at the well, which is in the Johannine Gospel. And the importance of that story is that the woman at the well was a Samaritan, and Samaritans were hated. And yet, Jesus is having a profound theological discussion with the woman at the well. And she, as a woman, is being very forthright with him and then goes on to tell other people of her encounter. And so I would say, I have a couple of thoughts about this. One is, who is your Samaritan in your life? And what do you need to do to approach that person as Jesus approached the Samaritan woman at the well? The other thought that I have is there's a term in clinical psychology called projection identification. And when I'm up against someone that I'm having a hard time with, one of the things that I try to do is there's something about that person I don't like, and I think it may be because I'm somehow like that person. I mean, think how often about how that may happen to you. That's called, I'm projecting onto you that which I see in you and I don't like because it's a part of me that I have to get rid of. And that's very important for us as individuals to be aware of when we are having a hard time with someone. What is it about them that reminds us of us? A third thing just came to my mind is Martin Luther King Jr., of blessed memory, wore a clerical collar, not like this. This is a Roman collar, but with a little tab in the middle. And when he was having a hard time with someone, he would always go like this or like this in discussion to remind himself that he was baptized in the name of Jesus. And if you and the one of the truths about a clerical collar is that it's round, and one of the meanings of that is that when you wear a clerical collar, you are yoked to the teachings of Christ. So if you ever see me going like this, I'm reminding myself, Jesus, I am yoked to you, and I'd better behave in a manner that is modeling who you were in the world. Now I just gave myself away. I outed myself about that. Oh, tell me about it. Yes, absolutely. And not to watch a certain channel on TV.
We've heard a lot of talk about the individual, and we've heard a lot of talk about big organizations and prescriptions in religion. If I remember correctly, 30, 40 years ago, the Episcopal Church proscribed that women could not be priests. I would like to ask, how did that change come about?
You know, 30 or 40 years ago, I was just a child of mere 5 or 6. Is it? I mean, seriously, folks. Thank you for entering into my sense of denial. There's a very famous priest who is the priest of All Saints in Pasadena. The Reverend Canon Dr. George Regas. And he really started that movement. And it was very timely. And I think that, you know, the truth is that many women served with Jesus. Many, many, many women. I mean, it's the women who showed up the day of the crucifixion. The men kind of left. I mean, that's not a, that, I don't mean that as a sexist comment. Okay, go ahead. But I think that the church, the Episcopal Church, recognized that we need to be inclusive of women. So the first step was to, there are three passages in ordination. The first is you must be ordained as a deacon, and a deacon is a person of service to the church. They're usually non-stipendary. You have to be that first, and then you are ordained to the priesthood, and then others go on to be ordained to the bishopric. The presiding bishop in the United States is the Most Reverend Catherine Jeffrey Shorey. And in the Diocese of Los Angeles, we have three bishops, of course we do. Two of them are suffragan bishops or assistant bishops, and they're both women. And the other thing that the Episcopal Church did very, very early on is ordained to the diaconate, the priesthood, and the bishopric out gay and lesbian people. And now more and more and more Christian churches are following that. And also, a very close friend of mine was really behind Reform Judaism ordaining not only women, but out gay and lesbian people. And I think that that is sign and symbol of God's inclusivity to all people.
I'd like to thank you all for sharing your wisdom with us today, and I would like to direct this question towards Senior Swamiji. On the concept of Maya, I've been told two different beliefs at different times at Vedanta's temples, and I would like your take on it. One concept is that as we live in a state of illusion, we can actually create our own reality. For example, that we could create peace by simply going within ourselves and creating this new illusion within us. The other belief that I have heard is that we should be like a little bird in the tree, simply observing everything with wisdom and without judgment. So more or less accepting what goes on and having it not affect us. Now, these are two different beliefs. May I ask your opinion on either one or both of these beliefs? Thank you.
One point you mentioned, which is Maya, the concept of Maya. That's one. Okay, now, it's very difficult to make it clear in a short speech, but I shall try. Now, the whole philosophy of Vedanta, non-dualist system of philosophy, teaches one basic truth. And that truth is, the reality is one. It may manifest in so many different ways, but the reality is one. Now, and that reality is called Brahman as the cosmic reality. It is called Atman as the immanent reality residing in all of us. As the origin, the sustenance of the entire creation, universe, it is called Brahman. The same reality is present in all of us. So as is in its immanent dimension, it is called Atman. Now, everything else is Maya or Mithya. This is the basic principle, Brahma Satyam Jagat Mithya Jivo Brahma Eva Naparaha. Now, what's the meaning of Maya or Mithya? It only tells you that this world that you see around, the valleys, the mountains, the rivers, or what you buy from Trader Joe's, or what you see, the chairs and tables, all these things are not absolute realities, because they emerge at some point of time in the past, exist for some time, and vanish sometime in future. This is as true of an ant or an insect as of the whole universe. The whole universe itself may be a few billions or millions of years old. It may exist for a few millions or billions of years. But they also emerge in time, exist in time, and vanish in time. Vanishing means they change. Everything that is changeable or subject to change is real, but only in a relative sense. What is absolutely real is beyond change. It remains the same throughout. So Vedanta says God is the only reality that is permanently real, absolutely real. Real with the capital letter R. All these things that we see around, including our body, is real, but only in a relative sense. So relativity is defined in Vedanta as anything that belongs to time, space, and causation. So when somebody tells you this world is maya or mithya, it only means this world is not absolutely real. It means today we live in the world. Today we eat a kind of food, but that food becomes something else tomorrow. So this world may change, maybe after millions of years. So anything that is subject to change is not absolutely real, but not absolutely unreal. So when you translate the word maya into illusion, we are making a very serious blunder. Swami Vivekananda was the first Indian teacher who corrected this translation of maya into the English word illusion. In fact, this translation was done by a Portuguese missionary who lived in Goa in the 16th century, who translated one portion of Shankara's commentary on the Upanishads into Portuguese, which later was translated into English. So it was wrongly translated as illusion, not deliberately, because they couldn't get a chance to study these philosophical ideas, Vedantic ideas under great teachers. So they did their best. So the word maya is not illusion. Maya is only relative. It means relativity. So if somebody tells you this table is maya, it doesn't mean that it is totally non-existent. It is not non-existent. If it were non-existent, we won't be able to sit on a chair. If it were really existent, then after millions of years also we'll be able to sit on it, which is not possible. So that's the reality. So anything which is not absolutely real is relative. And there is only one reality that is absolutely real, that is Brahman. In a way, it means God. God is absolutely real. Everything else is real only for the time being. That's all. That's the meaning of word maya.
In continuation with what our profound Swamiji, Revered Swamiji said, I think the philosophy is, if I am not wrong, is to behold the truth. But we don't see it because we have some veils. Like we don't see the flame enveloped by smoke or the image in a mirror is soiled. Or we don't see the child in the womb till the time comes. Is it in the same line of philosophy, Swamiji?
When our mind becomes pure through the practice of unselfishness, meditation, purity of life, devotion, prayer, and so on, then the reality becomes more and more obvious to us. What's the difference between a saint and a person who may not be a saint? The difference is a saint's mind is clear like a crystal. But a person who is not a saintly person, his mind is clouded, dusty, full of dirt and filth. Through meditation, through prayer, through surrender to God, through the practice of holiness in life, if that person's mind becomes pure, then he will feel the presence of the Lord within himself or herself. So the mirror gets slowly cleaned up. That's the idea.
A wonderful afternoon. It seems to me that when your religious traditions first found their way on this earth, your mission statement did not include world peace. My question is, how did your mission statement, as your presence here today indicates, include or evolve to a responsibility for world peace? And how does your tradition presently see its responsibility to bring about world peace?
Well, I think that Christianity, based on the life of Jesus Christ, his whole ministry was about peace. There wasn't anyone that he didn't minister to, including the Samaritan woman. He healed anyone. He was very, very much toward peace and reconciliation. And the Episcopal Church is based on that. As I mentioned, out of our covenant that we have, both the baptismal covenant and many of the other sacraments of the Church. So I do believe that Jesus was very clear about who he was in the world and what he expected. He did not, you know, I love the bumper sticker. I'm so glad that Jesus wasn't taught by Christians. I don't think that it was Jesus' intention to begin Christianity as we know it today. But when we follow the teachings of Christ, we are a peaceable people.
And there's, you know, there's no real beginning to Hinduism. It just evolved through the inspiration of the rishis and their inner meditation. And everything you read in the Upanishads is about finding that peace within. It's all an individual realization type of advice. It's not dealing with the social issues of the day at all that I see. Do you want to come?
My question is, actually, we are talking today more about peace and war. And we are all people of around age 60 and so. So don't you think that we should get engaged more like younger generation of 20s and 30s in this kind of discussion?
We had a wonderful one yesterday afternoon. We had a panel of young people talking about spiritual life and student life. But yes, it would be wonderful. So that's your job. Each of you needs to bring some young folks.
No, that's absolutely correct. When I go to all the meetings that I go to, and also with my own center, we are a graying population. Mm-hmm. And I think it's very, very important to bring young people on to be infused with the love of this work. One of the things that I've been trying to do since the Gibord Center was instituted four and a half years ago is to create a young people's advisory council, and it's hard. It's hard not because there isn't the interest, but kids don't drive. And, you know, they're into ballet and soccer and touch football and all that kind of stuff that's all very important as they build up their bodies and so forth. And also learn how to cooperate in community. But I think it's very, very important that all of us do everything that we can to get young people involved toward working in community. You know who's particularly good with that is the Mormon Church. The Mormon Church is really great about involving young people. And when they say they're going to have an event, the whole stake, that's what a church is called, like a convening place is called a stake. They all show up and do volunteer work. That we can really look at that model about how good the LDS Church is with that.
My question kind of relates to what you just said in a way. I was thinking about models of interfaith cooperation, and there's one I know of in Rhode Island where different faiths come together, faith leaders, and they talk about issues, and they come to some kind of concurrence about a variety of issues, and then they present their proposals to the legislature about what needs to be done. I mean, that's a political forum, I know, but I think it's very powerful to have faith groups come together and talk about issues. Certainly peace is a high priority. But it gives the message that religions aren't the problem. It's how people perceive religions. Mm-hmm. And the more discussion can be had across different faiths, the more opportunity there is to show those similarities. Another example I'll just throw out really quickly is a book I read called On Heaven and Earth. And it was actually by Pope Francis. Before he was Pope, when he was in Buenos Aires, he befriended a rabbi. And they had kind of like fireside talks, and they talked about different issues. And it came out by reading that book that there's a lot of similarities in a lot of the issues between those two faiths, and that's healing. And I just wanted to throw that out.
I think that there are two kinds of work that are being done in the interfaith community. One is where there are some very serious dialogues that are going on between Jews and Muslims, between Muslims and Christians, between Buddhists and Roman Catholics, et cetera, et cetera. And then the other is when they join people of faith, different faiths join together for an action like raising money for the recent earthquakes in Nepal, or gathering toys for children during Advent, the Advent season, and Christmas, or for kids on that are homeless. So there's the dialogue. Let's be together and talk with one another. And then there's all the action stuff that happens. And again, it's neither or. It's both. Both need to happen.
Two things. One, to Reverend, I would like to humbly point out that Swami Vivekananda, on September 11, 1893, his five magical words were sisters and brothers of America.
Yes.
So he spoke about sisters first, gave respect, high respect to American women who helped him a lot in his mission. And another thing, I have written a whole book about September 11 address of Swami Vivekananda titled The Day of Gloom and Glory. It was the day of gloom, September 11, 2001, when America was attacked. But hardly any American know about September 11, 1893, where Swamiji gave a message for world peace. If world had followed his message, we wouldn't see so many wars and chaos in the world. Another thing, question for both Swamijis. Swami Vivekananda said that with advent of Ramakrishna, Sri Ramakrishna, Satya Yuga started, age of truth. As we know, this is age of Kali Yuga, age of quarrels and wars and so on. But Swamiji said that with the advent of Sri Ramakrishna, age of truth has started. So I don't understand this statement. Though I have made my own interpretation, I would like to know your interpretations.
And before you do that, thank you for that correction, sir. Very, very much. I appreciate that.
Well, these ages take a while to evolve. They don't just suddenly change. It's not like going to a theater and you're watching a comedy now and then the next minute you're suddenly watching something else. There's a whole transition. It's like an enormous steamer that's changing course. And so from our limited perspective, we don't see necessarily the change because we're too close to it and the change is too gradual. So we'll have to, if you want to see it, you'll have to be reborn. So I'm not recommending it.
I'd like to ask a question which relates to the esoteric versus the exoteric side of religion. And it's really simply this, that it seems to me that the number of people who have become enlightened or who have created the mystical writings that remain are very, very, it's very, very few people. And so all the mystical writing seems to suggest that the world is perfect as it is, and that the world now with Ebola and ISIS and earthquakes and everything is perfect as it is. And I get a strong consensus in this tent that people have judgment that the world needs improving and quickly. And so it seems to me there's a real deep conflict here, because I think the one person I've ever encountered who I would consider enlightened felt that the world was perfect as it is, and it's only our upbringing and what we've been called the filters that in fact makes us think that everything's wrong and needs to be improved. Perhaps peace concerns an individual holding on to of relation with God in the midst of chaos. But it's individual. Chaos is more or less permanent. And we shouldn't really be worrying about improving the world. Could you address that?
I think your assertion that all mystics consider this world as they see it as permanent or it is perfect. I do not agree with that view, because mysticism starts, it begins out of a kind of inner discontentment, an urge, a quest for higher transcendental experience. That's the very beginning of mysticism in religion and spirituality. So all great mystics are great seekers of some transcendental truth that's beyond world, be this world, that's trans-empirical. When they get disappointed, when they get when they feel that the world, the empirical phenomenal world that they see around them is not perfect, there should be a higher reality, a higher truth that goes beyond the present, beyond the empirical, beyond the today. That's the beginning of all mystical quest. So maybe they are looking for a state of perfection, but that state of perfection is beyond the empirical world, the world of today that they live in. So that's one point to remember. So it's an effort, it's a quest for the transcendental truth. And they want to realize that transcendental truth in their own inner life. They want to experience it in their own mind, in their own individual life. That's the essence of mysticism in all religious and spiritual traditions. The other one you're talking about is kind of pantheism, where you equate the world, the external world, nature with God. That is not mysticism. So.
Well, Swami Vivekananda, I think, had glimpses of the universe where he would find the whole thing humorous and in some sense perfect, just the way it was, that everything was interrelated and there were, you could see it from a transcendent level, how everything connected. But he still, when he came back down, he felt this great urge to help humankind. So I don't think just because a mystic sees the workings of the universe at a transcendent level, to have this magnificent perfection in that highest state, when they come back down, they will still see the problems of the world and feel impelled to work. Of course, there's the story of the three people that come up, hear laughter on the other side of the wall, and yeah, the two of them go up and they see what a wonderful place it is on the other side of the wall, so they jump over and join them. The third one is willing to come back and let other people know about it and try to help them as well. So you get these little parables and so forth that indicate these different levels of realization, or the bodhisattva ideal. Rather than just going into your own illumination, you come back to try to help humankind.
I remember when the Episcopal Church first made women priests, and I thought, now that's progress. Women give birth. Women aren't going to send their sons off to war so easily. They're going to fight for peace. And I believe that most religions in the world are, what's the word, paternalistic. Most of the religions in the world are headed by men. So my question was, in Vedanta, has there been a shift or a change in the position of women within the structure of Vedanta society? Have women always been equal? Are women at the top? And has there been change over time? That's my question. Thank you.
Do you want to talk about the order, or do you want me to talk about it?
You find two of the greatest philosophers of ancient Vedic times were women. There were many, but two of them are very well known. One was Gargi, the other was Maitri. So they were debating higher spiritual, philosophical, metaphysical topics with the greatest philosophers of those times. But during the post-Vedic times, due to invasion of large number of non-Vedic civilizations, this tradition gradually faded away. And but if you look at the Vedic way of life, women were given Vedic education, they were given the sacraments, and they were held in high position. On the top, I can't say, but they were on the same position as men, had the same high position as the menfolk. And in a traditional Vedic family, the most respected figure was the mother. So after 12 years of instruction in a Vedic hermitage in ancient times, a young man, when he goes back to his home, the instructor, the teacher, used to give a kind of convocation address. Matru Devo Bhava, Pitru Devo Bhava. This is how he begins. I mean, the first instruction is, you should honor your mother, respect your mother as much as you respect God himself. It's a metaphor. It means you should revere your mother, respect your mother as much as you respect God himself. So, women were held in high position. If we look at the Mahabharata, some of the greatest characters are women folk. In fact, according to many literary critics, the greatest character of Mahabharata was Krishna, and one was Kunti, the mother of the five Pandava brothers. So, but what happened? You know, India is a very ancient civilization. We have no recorded history. Mahabharata itself speaks of a culture and civilization that may have prevailed in the 4th millennium BC. And Vedas are much more ancient than the Mahabharata. So it's a gradually evolved society. To give an example, if you compare Homer's Iliad with Ramayana, you can just see. In Ramayana, the archetypal feminine character is Sita. And in Iliad, the counterpart is Helen. You see, if you see the contrast, you'll understand. So, but then what happened? After several millennia, over the centuries, things changed. Because there was a lot of racial and cultural intermingling in India. Series of invasions from Central Asia, during the period of Hunas attack, Mihiragula, when Attila was trying to destroy Roman Empire, his Indian counterpart, means he was another Hun, you could pronounce, Hun leader was Mihiragula, who was attacking India. So there was a lot of intermingling of races and cultures. So due to all these social cataclysms, a lot of changes took place. So that's a lot of thing. I shall conclude this answer with one important point. If you get a glimpse of the Vedic way of life, you feel we have traveled backward in terms of culture and civilization. It was a civilization where everyone can meditate, can evolve in spiritual life. The family life was considered to be a sacred undertaking. And religious harmony was the essence of Vedic way of life. I'm not talking about the present condition, but as it prevailed during the 5th or 6th millennium BC. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. I'd like to thank each one of you for the clarity and the pleasantness with which you have imparted your spiritual wisdom today. My question has more to do with method rather than substance. The older I get, the less I seem to know to be absolutely true. The more I read, the more I think, the more I listen, I found truths, but there are very few of them that are absolutely true, and they change as I get older. And I also come to the conclusion that trying to learn really doesn't accomplish as much as doing something. And with that in mind, if I were to fashion the rest of my life just concentrating on making my actions with compassion, empathy, kindness, and a little altruism, do I still need to study religion and spiritualism? Thank you.
You know, the more you can put it into practice, the better. There's a point where the reading does not need to continue. The reading is helpful to keep your mind focused on what it is you want to be practicing. So for many people, they have to continue reading the scriptures and reminding themselves of the principles they're trying to practice. Otherwise, life gets kind of ahead of you and you forget what you're supposed to be doing. So that's the value of scriptures. But the main focus of that has to be to continue the practices, not just to continue to learn. As you say, he who knows, he knows not. You know, that's what it says in the Upanishads. You can't ever put all of this in words, and eventually the words have to drop away, and it has to be your knowledge from within that's realized in a deeper wordless sense, and that comes through the practice of the way you live your life. So study for the purpose of reminding yourself how to live your life.
I just, before you get to the next question, I know this person here wants to ask a question. I think it's important not to call it, to not get hung up on the word learning, rather than to have a disciplined life in terms of prayer and in terms of reading, not for the purpose of gaining more knowledge per se, but for the purpose of grounding one so that one can go out and do the work.
We will have just one more question for want of time. Then we will have meditation. Then all of you can interact with the speakers after the meditation, after the conclusion of the program. If you get time. Okay.
Oh, I'd like to thank the panel, and I really got a lot out of being here. It brought up something, especially Dr. Gifford's comment about who benefits from war, and it seems like it's the corporate interests that make so much money. And I think the corporations have a way of dividing religions, not only against each other, but also within each religion. And I'm wondering, how as an individual can you feel less powerful or have some meaning in trying to live out a spiritual life against what I see as the real evil behind it all, which is corporate interests, both in our government and in the military throughout the world?
For me, that means if one invests in the corporate world vis-a-vis the stock market, to invest in those stocks that don't build up warfare, that don't, for cosmetic companies that don't do animal experimentation, to invest responsibly following the tenets of your particular faith. And I think that's true, that in terms of being involved politically, that to insist, in a way, by your vote, by showing up and vote. Don't get discouraged. Go out and vote for those people that are going to follow the tenets of a moral life, what I would call a moral life, a life of integrity.